Now, on to migration matters now, and we're hearing today that more than 40 tents have been pitched by asylum seekers along the Grand Canal in Dublin. The location is less than 400 metres from the International Protection Office on Mount Street, from where tents were removed earlier this week and barriers put up. The UK continues to come in for criticism for its Rwanda bill, but are EU member states and the EU institutions themselves in any position to take the moral high ground when it comes to the treatment of those seeking international protection? I put this question to Eve Geddy, an Irish woman who is head of Amnesty International's European Institutions Office.
Well, the Rwanda deal, it's part of this broader trend that we see a lot of governments in Europe following of externalisation of migration, of engaging countries, either countries of origin, for instance, sub-Saharan Africa or elsewhere, or countries of transit where migrants are passing through to reach Europe in deals which are really based on stopping arrivals and facilitating returns. From a migration angle, these are really solidifying quite an ineffective and short-sighted approach to migration. There's lots of ways which you can cooperate with countries of origin and transit. We would see, and there's examples of those being far more positive and long-term and evidence-based. And I think it really creates this engagement with other countries, which is also about migrants being seen as a problem.
And is it consistent in your view for Ireland, which is, you know, a member of the European Convention on Human Rights, to be on the one hand critical of the UK's Rwanda policy and on the other hand looking at ways to send people back to the UK where they might be subjected to deportation under this policy were it to come into effect?
I think I think it's important that Ireland is, of course, looking at its own responsibility. I mean, it's on one hand, it is acceptable to be able to say this agreement doesn't, you know, meet with international human rights obligations. At the same time, you know, indeed, as you said, it's important to see how Ireland could then be complicit if somebody then gets deported from Dublin, say, back to the UK and then ends up on a forced flight back to Rwanda. Then, Ireland would be complicit. So it's important to call it out, but then also, I think, take a higher ground and, you know, show a better response ourselves as well.
What's your analysis of this asylum and migration pact? Is it an improvement on the situation that exists at the moment, or does it make things worse?
Well, in our view as Amnesty, we really see this pact is going to worsen the situation, you know, for member states looking to deal with migration, but also create a lot more suffering and chaos for people arriving. What we're going to see with this pact across Europe is more detention, and here including families, even with children, behind barbed wire fences. The pact even allows member states to suspend these rights when they have increased arrivals at their border. This is a key concern for Amnesty. We have seen such measures abused by European governments in recent years. In 2021, Latvia and Lithuania claimed states of emergency at their borders when they had arrivals from Belarus. And what this meant in practice was NGOs were not able to access the border, neither were journalists. People were being detained without any kind of process, abandoned in sub-zero temperatures, and there was extreme suffering and even deaths there. So the pact, it basically allows member states to suspend them when they have this so-called instrumentalization.
And yet the UN High Commission on Refugees is broadly approving of this pact. So what makes you right and them wrong?
Well, we also had a large body of UN independent experts, so UN special rapporteurs, who came out yesterday and critiqued the pact and said from their perspective, they see this pact being very damaging. And I think many of their calls and concerns would align with ours. So for the EU to, you know, send the message globally that 27 countries together who are, you know, taking a much smaller proportion of refugees compared to other parts of the world, that even they need to opt out of asylum or lower the standards and not meet human rights protections. That sends a really worrying message. We've seen also in recent years some of Europe's best examples in terms of responding to people at the border, a really kind of sustainable, pragmatic solution. I'm thinking here on the Ukrainian example, the 27 member states decided, let's activate the temporary protection directive, let's let people come in, you know, get a roof over their heads, feel safe and be able to process their claims and get protection. So this too is Europe, and this too is the vision, I think, that has real potential.
The distinction though between people who are asylum seekers and people who are economic migrants, when the system is under pressure, there is a demand, a public demand, for the system to be discerning between those two categories of immigrants. I mean, how does the system do that in the fairest possible way, in your view?
Well, I think one thing is that the status of migrants can change. You know, somebody can come with an asylum claim, they can, you know, then find themselves working. Someone can come on a student visa, have that visa lost, become an undocumented or so-called economic migrant. Another thing is, so it's a very fluid process and the different statuses we have. I think another thing is that, you know, the vast majority of people in Ireland, you know, we know ourselves from our own history of migration. You know, Irish people migrated, some fleeing war, fleeing conflict, but many Irish people also migrated for better economic opportunity. You know, and I'm here working in Brussels on, you know, EU policy. And one thing that's really been very proud to see in the last few months has been the leadership that the Irish government has shown on the situation in Gaza. And I think there's also an opportunity there for the Irish government to show itself as a leader on human rights, refugees and migrants. We have that strong history of migration. We have many people abroad. It is a complex issue. It is something that needs a lot of political will and a long-term vision. But I think we're really ideally placed to do that.
And that was Eve Gowdy, head of Amnesty International's European Institutions Office, speaking to me there. Senator John McGann, I just want to ask you first about this new encampment along the Grand Canal. There's barriers put up in Mount Street. This is 400 metres away. The only thing that's really changed is exactly that, 400 metres in terms of a location of a tent encampment.
Yeah, and it's quite clear to me that in the last 2 years, we've housed over 100,000 people, an unprecedented amount of people. And it wouldn't be responsible or realistic message to send to people who want to come to this country, either via work visas or through asylum, to say that we will be able to provide accommodation for absolutely every single person. That's not realistic. We want to try and do that, absolutely. We tried to do that earlier this week when we moved a lot of those people who are in those tents. And by the way, they're human beings. They shouldn't be in those tents. They don't want to be in those tents. We don't, as a country, want them in those tents. They were given accommodation in City West. They were given accommodation elsewhere. Some then subsequently left that accommodation and came back to Mount Street. Why? I don't know. I can't ask why someone would rather be in a tent on a street than in City West.
Are you saying these are the same people? And what's your source?
It's hard to gauge how many of the people are, but it was clear to me this morning when I inquired about it that some people had left City West already. But I am reluctant because the situation is fluid, it's changing, and I am reluctant to say anything one way or the other because I'm just simply not certain about it. But that's where it is. We don't want these people in tents. We want to try and get them into the system. Some of them have been referred to the homeless system as well through Dublin City Council and other local authorities in Dublin. It is absolutely not ideal, and I'm not here to try and say it is. We're working with those people who are there. We're trying to get them into accommodation. We want roofs over their heads. We want them to be looked after. And it's not a good situation that they're in at the minute.
All right. The Asylum and Migration Pact that's currently being debated before the Dáil, what material difference would it make to this situation?
Well, it does a couple of things. And I think the Migration Pact in itself is going to be a good thing. So one thing that it does do is where people have, say, had an asylum claim rejected and it has to go back to another member state, we can only offer a request for that state to take them back. Under the Migration Pact, the other member states will have to take them back. The other good things about the Migration Pact is that it's actually going to speed up processing times. It's going to give us access to wider EU databases and wider security checks. Again, that can only be a good thing. And from an Irish perspective, the biggest issue that we face is what's called secondary movement, which is somebody comes to one country, claims asylum, gets it processed, then comes here. It's actually going to then allow us to maintain a much more efficient level of making sure that people who claim asylum are getting processed and getting decisions made in the countries where they claim asylum.
Sure. Are you sure about that though? Because somebody doesn't have to claim, as you know, people don't have to claim asylum in the first country they land in. Sure. So if somebody lands in Europe in a regime that's harsher than Ireland, and Ireland has committed to not detaining people, they're providing them with accommodation, isn't it eminently possible that people will come to Ireland if Ireland treats them humanely? And what you're selling this pact on the basis of won't come to pass at all?
No, they're absolutely entitled to come to this country to make their first claim asylum here. That's absolutely fine. But under this pact, we're going to have better access to data, better access to security, a more efficient and streamlined process to actually process those asylum seekers in the first instance. And what I would say from an Irish perspective, and this is what wasn't touched on with the point from the Amnesty International, is we are a small nation on the peripheral edge of the European Union. We cannot do this alone. We have to do this in cooperation and conjunction with the other 25 to 27 member states. We have to do this on a basis where we can all work together with it. And if Ireland didn't opt into this, it would be quite clear to me that we would see a higher increase of secondary movement, we would see slower processing times for people, and we would probably see more people coming here because it would be easier to come here than other EU member states.
Roisin Shortall, the situation, first of all, on the Grand Canal, people were cleared out of Mount Street, moved to Crooks Ling in the foothills of the Dublin Mountains and out to City West as well. And here's another encampment again. What would you do in this situation?
Well, I think that the most important thing to do is to follow the advice from the expert groups that have been making recommendations now since 2020. The Catherine Day report that the government established, the expert group, that report was provided to government in 2020. There was a second report then last year. And it would seem that the government has completely ignored those recommendations. I mean, the clear recommendation from 2020 was that we needed to plan ahead. We need a strategy for dealing with this. You know, this government and previous governments have operated on the basis that migration is a temporary issue. And, you know, you're fooling yourself if you think that that's the case. With wars around the globe, with climate change in addition to that, there's a huge movement of people. And we need a strategy in place to fairly but firmly deal with applications.
And do you think the
asylum.
Catherine Day report that recommended the closing down of direct provision and the building of other centres anticipated the scale of what Ireland is dealing with at the moment?
Not in 2020, but I think in the updated report, in the updated report, that group certainly did. Now, you know, here we are 4 years later and not a single reception centre has been built. There was a recommendation for 6 reception and accommodation centres and the government hasn't even identified the locations for those and said they wouldn't until after the local elections.
Where would you put them and how big would they be?
You would identify suitable places. And
do you have any suggestions?
Well, sorry, I'm not going to say here now. That's not my job. But there are locations that you can provide centres in that are properly run, that are owned and run by the state, rather than the present situation where, you know, it's so chaotic that anybody who happens to come along and offer accommodation, that's accepted, irrespective of whether that's appropriate accommodation, irrespective of whether the person has any experience. And there are a lot of people making an awful lot of money out of this whole system. And I really think, Colm, that it's rich for John to say that under the migration pact, we would have a streamlined system. There's nothing stopping the government having a streamlined system at the moment. And, you know, it's reprehensible that they have shown a blind eye to all this. We need proper centres and we need proper processing, a speedy system that's in place that gives people decisions in a timely manner.
Okay.
And we haven't had that.
I'll come back to you in a moment, John McGann, because I do want to go to Michael Fitzmaurice. Okay. Michael Fitzmaurice, something you've been critical of as well is the amount of money that's been made in the private provision of accommodation for asylum seekers. Would you support what Roisin Shortall is talking about there and indeed the other calls for state-provided accommodation in major centres to be provided to asylum seekers?
Well, first of all, I think that if you look at other countries, they generally have them near airports and ports. What's happening is, and let's step back a small bit here, and I think that people have to be able to be, you know, given an honest, and give me a minute to explain this. First of all, it's not the person, the asylum seeker's fault, because if you saw a tweet in 2021 that you'll have your own door, which Roger Gogorman sent out, that basically all the terms and conditions, if you were in Ireland, which was sent out in different languages to all the different people, but that travels all over the world. And in fairness to anybody that's living in tough conditions, they might say, this is the land of opportunity, and they'd go there. So let's not be blaming
the pictures of tents travel all over the world as well.
Correct, so that information has been updated since then. The problem is in this country at the moment is that we have a Department of Justice that's not enforcing the laws that we have. and is not basically processing the applicants. Let's look back. There are 40 tents you're after telling me there, basically along the canal. Why is there 7,000 to 8,000 people that have been refused basically to stay in this country, not that we don't know whether they're gone back or not gone back? That's 7,000 or 8,000 beds that we don't know as a country. At the moment, we are hearing about people coming across the UK. We don't know who they are. And, you know, people will talk about borders. You can't, you won't have a border.
What do you mean by we don't know who they are?
Well, first of all, people have been coming down across the border. How do you know who came across the border? Because obviously,
do you mean
it's
numbers?
An open border.
Or, do you mean numbers or
numbers,
country
of
origin?
I'm talking about numbers. We don't know, is that a correct number or not? And what's the big problem here? The problem is that we're not processing the applicants quickly enough. The Department of Justice and the minister seems to be in disarray. And on top of that, in any world or in any walk of life, can you have a system that, be it you get a letter or that you're in court and a judge tells you that you have to leave the country, and after that we don't know whether they go or not? How can that add up? The figures at the moment are 8,000 last year, and we don't know, are they taking up beds tonight or are they gone?
All right, John McGann.
Yeah, a couple of things just to pick up from what Roisin and Micah said. And Roisin, if I'm correct in saying this, you said the issue is that we need a speedy system in a timely manner. Is that correct?
Decisions in a timely manner, yeah.
Yeah, I assume you know what the fast track system is, which has been introduced since November 2020.
Since November.
So, yeah, 2022, yeah. So just to be clear, let's talk about speediness.
But you're talking about these things as if it happened overnight.
I didn't interrupt you. This happened in November 2022. That's over, you know, nearly 18 months ago longer. So let's talk about a speedy manner. The fast track system, people now get decisions within 90 days if they're coming from a country that's considered to be a safe country, i.e. there's no political or religious persecution in it. Of those people who are applying for that, they get a decision within 90 days. Now, what's good about that is two things. First of all, it means that people who absolutely...
This is an initial decision, is it?
This is something that Minister Helen McEntee has brought in, and it's an initial decision. So
right.
It does
which
two,
they can then
it
appeal.
It does two good things. First of all, it means that people who deserve protection, who should be in this country, get that level of protection. Second of all, it means that people who do come here, who don't get that level, who don't prove that they're being persecuted or don't say anything like that, and their claim is proven to not exist, don't get to come here. And finally, it actually works because we've seen a 50% decrease in people coming from these countries. We've seen it with Nigeria, we've seen it with Albania, we've seen it by Georgia. Now, to me, that is swift and speedy. But to talk about more swift and speediness, let's look what else Helen McEntee has done. Since January of this year, there's been 1,500 doorstep operators. Now, I just want to finish this point because accusations were made. There's been 1,500 doorstop issues at planes where people are quizzed. 100 people have been prosecuted in this country for arriving without passports. We've seen 35% decrease in people
sure,
arriving.
Do you want to
passports.
Specifically answer the point raised by Michael Fitzmaurice about the numbers of people who've been issued with notices to tell them they don't have leave to remain?
For 2023.
Yeah, well, let's talk
that.
About that then. So again, in last year, and this is coming from the Department of Justice in Innes, 760 deportation orders were issued last year. Of that, 96% left this country voluntarily. 96%.
How do we know
that?
That is information from Innes, from the Department of Justice, that I have received this week. That's how we know it. The other issue with it is as well, is we've seen a 44...
Why could the minister not provide
really,
that information?
I'm really keen, because you've made some accusations.
Very,
so
very briefly now, because I do have to get to the other panelists
across.
Now.
So when we talk about speediness, 5,000 interviews have taken place this year as a result of 2,800 last year. We've seen 4,000 decisions made in 2021. That's now up to 14,000 this year. Why? Because we trebled the staff in the IPO to get the speedy decisions that you're saying don't exist.
Okay, all right.
And this is stats.
Okay.
This is data. This isn't rhetoric.
All right, Roisin Shorthall.
John seems to be throwing out a lot of figures there that
and what's
aren't
wrong
in the
with
public
figures?
Domain. No,
sorry.
Okay, all right. No, hang on a second. John McGann, you're not going to interrupt her now. You just complained about being interrupted yourself.
Allow me to finish the sentence, please.
Answer.
You're throwing out figures that are not actually in the public domain. Now, maybe they do stand up. I don't know. But everybody has been having difficulty in getting figures that are reliable. And the point has been made that unless we're measuring these things, it doesn't get managed properly.
All right.
So, but you know, there's huge uncertainty about the situation.
You got those figures from where?
I've got all of these figures this week, where this is now my fourth interview on this topic
in preparation
from the Department of Justice.
Are they publicly available?
Whether they're publicly available or not, I'm going to find out. But what I wouldn't
do...
Sorry. What I would never do in a million years is come on to another interview with another parliamentarian of quality and question the figures that I've had. These are all absolute facts that are coming from the Department of Justice. 5,000 interviews this year compared to 2,800 last year.
What did you say about Nigerians there?
Nigeria is now on the safe list. Nigeria has now been added to the safe list for the fast track system.
Yeah, but you said something about a 50% reduction.
There's been a 50% reduction in people applying for asylum in this country on the fast track system when that country has been put on.
Okay.
I want to go back to Michael Fitzmaurice there. Some of the figures that have been laid out there by John McGann, they've been provided to him. Have you asked specific questions for numbers on this, Michael Fitzmaurice, in answer to some of the questions you've raised?
Yeah, we have asked for figures, and look, figures weren't coming. As Michael McNamara, in fairness to him, highlighted in the committee, there was a question he had asked, and it was 2 months and he hadn't got an answer. And if you want to go on stats and facts, and I'm not questioning John what he's saying, but to be a great thing if everyone else was told about it. The UK accepted 200 people under the agreement that was there from Ireland. None of them were sent. That's a stat that the UK have given. Is that correct? 7,000 to 8,000 people were refused when they went through the process last year. Can John tell me, with his hand on his heart, that them 7,000 to 8,000 people are now somewhere else? And if they are in Ireland, no wonder then this tense in...
All right. That's the second time you've raised that. John McGann, do you want to address that specifically?
I just couldn't hear it there. Sorry, Michael.
Sorry, the 7,000 to 8,000 people that Michael Fitzmaurice is talking about that didn't get leave to remain. Does the government know
where they are?
If you want to put your headphones on, you'll be able to hear Michael Fitzmaurice there. I'll give you a chance to do that. So the 7,000 to 8,000 people, Michael Fitzmaurice raised it again in a previous point. Does the state know where those people are? Go when they are issued with notices that refuse them leave to remain.
Sorry, I don't understand the question. I missed that, Michael, at the start. I couldn't hear you when you first said it. So if you
you want, whichever way you want it.
Well, I couldn't.
Let's not have an argument over heard or not.
It has been reported that 7,000 to 8,000 people were refused basically to be in this country when they went through the process last year. I think it's actually nearer to 8. Where are those people today? Because no one seems to be able to account for it.
That's the question.
And hold on, let me finish my second one. 200 people were accepted, and I mean the word accepted, by the UK a couple of years ago, and not one person was sent back. Why is that?
Well, let's take the last one, 200 people. I can only take you at your word, Michael, for that stat. But when we look at the system...
It's the British government that has said it.
Yeah, that's fair enough.
It's not me.
So that they said they'd take 200 back. Well, as was seen in the Justice Committee last week, that nobody since 2020 was sent back under the new agreement. And the reason why that was because for 50% of the last 2 years we had COVID, where none of this was taking place. And for the other remainder of the last 4 years, we had a High Court case which would stop the whole process. That High Court case has now been resolved. A judgment has been made, and the government are coming in to legislate for that now to make sure that the UK is deemed a safe country so those people can go back.
I just want to ask a question, because everybody today on this discussion has raised the issue of a fair and rules-based system that gives people a decision on whether or not they have leave to remain and tells them whether or not they can stay in the country. Is it consistent anymore, Michael Fitzmaurice, for Irish governments to go over to the US on St. Patrick's Day and lobby on behalf of what we call undocumented and what many in the US call illegals?
Well, first of all, when Irish people went to the US, they had to get a visa. You can't get into the US without a visa. Second of all, they had a passport with them. Them are the two things that's qualified. What they have done then is overstayed basically their welcome.
Would you accept that some people who've arrived here have done exactly the same thing?
Yeah, some people may have done that. We have a process here, and we should basically, in fairness to, say, all EU countries, there's a process there. In America, there basically there isn't that process that you can go through the same as here. In Ireland,
well,
or
they,
in Europe,
they do have an asylum system. You can apply and you can do.
In fairness, when Irish people go over, they would be going over and they'd be working and. Basically, after
no,
that.
No, well, Michael, with respect, some of them go over on J1 visas and overstayed visas. Some of them go over on holiday visas. Some of them enter through Canada. But what they're doing now is illegal, and the US has a system to deal with that. The Irish government lobbies consistently on behalf of those people. Is it inconsistent for political representatives in Ireland to be calling for an efficient rules-based system and then go over to the US and effectively ask the system there to bend the rules?
The difference, in my opinion, is people come here, as a refugee, be it an economic refugee or otherwise. People went to America.
Well,
they're
with
working.
Respect, there's no
there
such thing as an economic refugee. There's somebody who may look to improve their material circumstances as a migrant, and then there are people who make a claim of asylum, which is then assessed by a system based on certain criteria.
Yeah, but in America, those people wouldn't actually be. Without a home, because when they went to America, they'd have started working and they would basically have accommodation. It's actually a different scenario than what happens here. What happens here is somebody comes in, they don't unfortunately have a place to stay, they wouldn't have work, and what they do, they turn up and they look for to go through the asylum process, which is a different setup.
All right, so Roisin Chowdhury.
Yeah, there is, of course, inconsistency here. But this arguing back and forth about the figures points to the fact that there's no clear strategy here at all.
Could you just address, do you believe the Irish government should consistently continue to go over to the US and look for the undocumented Irish who are regarded as illegal in the US to be regularised?
I think there's an inconsistency in taking that approach politically and taking a very different approach in relation to people who come to this country seeking asylum. And, you know, that has been clear for some time. Look, there is no strategy here to deal with the migration issue. We need a system that is speedy and fair to process the applications that are made here. But in the meantime, also, we need to ensure that the centres of accommodation that are provided are properly run, that there's proper communication with local communities before centres are opened. And we've seen, I've an example in my own constituency in Santry, where there was a lot of uproar when it was first suggested that premises in Santry would be used for 300 male asylum seekers. The government did nothing about preparing the ground for that, did nothing about ensuring that there was local integration.
Right.
But thankfully, you know, the local area partnership and some community groups got involved, supported those men with English classes, with pre-employment training, with doing their CVs, and most of those are working now.
Very briefly.
And it's settled
very
down.
Briefly.
Do you know what I just think, Roisin, is the sheer hypocrisy of what you've just said there? Is because you've objected to housing in your constituency, and I quote, I'm reading it here, for housing oversupply. You said there's a very significant oversupply of housing in the area at the moment.
What year was that?
It's right here. How can you... if I can finish.
John McGann, all right, okay.
How can you object to housing in your constituency?
John McGann, I gave you an opportunity to respond to that.
Yeah.
You're after introducing... Do you or do you not know the year of that statement?
I'm going to come back to it about the
year. Okay, no, you don't.
I'll tell you what, we're
going to take a break because we have to move on.
We're
back after this.
Housing.
We're looking
at Saturday with Conor Mungon on RTE Radio 1. Saturday with Conor Mungon on RTE Radio 1.
Very briefly, Roisin Chowdhury.
I'm just saying, obviously.
When did you make
it? After the crash, there was an oversupply of housing. And, you know, I presume that statement is from that period. I've never said in the last decade that there was an oversupply of housing. Stop trying to confuse the situation.
We've got another important issue we need to move on to.